today, both Jen and I are going to be talking about Blade Runner. I'm going to start with sort of an introduction to the whole idea of dystopia and dystopian fiction, which is, I think, going to inform a lot of the stuff we'll do for the rest of the class, especially the cyberpunk stuff. And then Jen will probably be a little more specific as to Blade Runner as well. I wanted to start out, if I'm going to talk about dystopia, I figured the first thing I should do is talk about utopia. And I wanted to start out by getting some impressions from you guys about what you think utopia means. What is it? So, anybody.
A happy, perfect world.
A happy, perfect world. I'll buy that, yeah.
Flying machine.
Flying machine. How do you get that? Like, where does that come from? Okay.
Heaven on Earth.
Excuse me. Heaven on Earth. Fair enough. Fair enough. That sounds good. Yeah.
No crime, no money.
No money. Not just no crime, but no... No. So everybody has enough. It's all, you know...
Clean and pretty world.
Clean and pretty. Yeah.
World peace.
World peace. Absolutely. So it's a pretty rosy view. You don't get here. And I think that's pretty much the way the term has come down. I mean, it originally comes from a novel, or sort of a novel, by Thomas More, an English writer, although it was written in Latin, published in 1551 in English for the first time. And it offers a description of a fictive ideal society, basically along the lines of a lot of what you guys have said, based around notions of equality and social harmony and economic prosperity, and above all, political stability, basically, that things were set and they would not change and there would not be any problems. In presenting the story, More presents it as an account told him by another European, a traveler who'd been to this place, this land called Utopia, seen it, learned all about it, lived there for a while, and come back. And by doing so, tries to situate it as real, even though he makes no claim that this is not fiction at any point. The utopia that More presents is a completely planned community that is really based around controlling individual impulses for the common good. As my friend over there said, there was no money, rightly stated, there is no private property in More's utopia. Everyone wears the same clothes, even, so there's no envy of wealth or social status. And there's no pretext allowed for avoiding work. Everybody works, they all switch jobs occasionally, so that no one feels like they get the better deal. There's no bars, there's no place to go have much fun that isn't sanctioned by the state. There's no places you can go that you can hide or have secret meetings. But along with these things that sound maybe not as rosy a picture as the term utopia has come down to us, there's also no poverty, no hunger, no violence really, and no social problems of the sort that were common in more time and that are still common in ours. The word utopia is, the novel is written in Latin, as I said, but the word is actually from Greek root. And literally in Greek, it means no place. When pronounced in Latin, however, it means good place, just the difference in the oo sound at the beginning. And it's really the combination of these two meanings that I think still inform how we look at utopia. It is a place that is essentially fictive, that doesn't exist in our world, but at the same time, it's an ideal place, a place that we can potentially create. The novel, though, even though it describes this place, it wasn't only descriptive. It was also prescriptive. It wasn't about just telling you what this could be, but it's about offering a detailed blueprint of how to get there. And I think that's one of the ways that the term has really been played out over the years. You know, people look at it not as something just to portray in fiction, but as something that can be created, something that can be established and run. And there have been various tries of this over the past few centuries. None of them entirely successful, I think we would have known about it. But there's some downsides to this. I mean, in More's utopia, for it to function, it required the use of slave labor. It was basically sort of an imperialist element to it. They went to their neighbors, defeated them in battle, brought them back, had them do the really dirty work that no one else really wanted to do. And as I've already sort of alluded to, it was really defined by intense methods of social control. You really didn't have a lot of individual freedom, even if you were without want, you know, and you didn't have to worry about it after, you know. But these severe limits on individual freedom, I think, problematize the idea of utopia. And even though it has endured, I think there's always sort of another sense that comes with it, that it's not something to be entirely trusting. But basically, in the cultural imagination, what we really think of, I think, is the equality, harmony, prosperity. So, with all that in mind, what is dystopian? What is dystopian fiction? In the most basic sense, I think you could say that dystopia is the opposite of utopia. It refers to fictional societies that are incredibly imperfect, that are flawed in really fundamental ways, and lack the harmonious and egalitarian qualities of life depicted in utopian writing, utopian fiction and thinking. But it's not really exactly opposite, because most dystopias that have been imagined contain many of the same elements as utopias themselves. itself, mostly around these intense measures of social control. That's still, you know, an aspect that we see in both, and that, you know, being a problematic aspect in more fiction, in dystopian fiction, it is usually taking a horrific extreme, with emphasis really placed upon the very negative effect of controlling individuals that much, regardless of what you can get on the other side, regardless of the beneficial aspects of this. The term dystopia has been around since the 19th century. It's not new, although it was coined by an English writer, an economist from Boston named John Stuart Mill. But it's really as a genre of fiction, as a mode of thought, as a model that stories are written around. It really only took off in the 20th century, and that's become increasingly prevalent since World War II for a number of reasons, which I'll get into. It's a very different world, for one. But if dystopian literature, you could see, I think, is a subset of a larger category of anti-utopian literature. But anti-utopian literature would be something that really just satirizes utopian thinking. The distinction with dystopian literature is that dystopian lit offers something else. It offers a model and says what's wrong, really, with utopian models of society. It's often implicit. It's not necessarily a direct, and very rarely, in fact, a direct screed against utopian thinking or against a notion of the future as a rosy idea. But implicit is almost always some kind of commentary. Dystopian fictions are fundamentally concerned with problems of the political and the cultural context that produces them. Think about that. That's really an essential point, I think. They are, as much as any kind of writing I've come across, really attached to their context, really directly referencing it. And an example of that, I think probably the best known example of that, is 1984 by Orwell. It's written in 1949, shortly after the end of World War II, and basically portrays a totalitarian state that is profoundly oppressive and whose reason for being really is to maintain absolute control over individuals, including their thoughts, the thought police and Big Brother. And if you think about what you know, the world had just gone through right before 1949, it was basically the rise and conflict with totalitarian states on both sides, with the Soviets under Stalin, and which would continue, obviously, for many decades, and with Nazi Germany. Like utopian writing, there is as I've been saying, a prescriptive element. It's not just descriptive. Dystopian fictions almost always offer some kind of warning, even if it is implicit, of what will happen should present trends continue. That said, if it came out in the 20th century, what are some of the present trends that it would be referring to, that it would be operating again? Anybody want to offer any suggestions? Yeah.
Capitalism.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably depends upon the part of the world that the fiction is coming from, because people have different views depending on where you are. Absolutely. Yeah, that.
Cloning.
Yeah. That's very recent. Can you name any dystopian stories about cloning? Yeah, neither can I.
Six today.
Hmm?
Yeah.
I guess that is about cloning,
really.
Yeah.
Six Day also.
What was that?
Six Day.
Six Day. I'm
familiar with that. That's one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's more recent ones.
Oh. Okay. Does it do it well?
It's better than you think.
Anything else? Yeah. Genetic engineering, absolutely. These are all really current concerns, too. And I think the dystopian fiction being written now is really going to be playing with a lot of it, and over the last 10 years, too. Yeah.
Nuclear power.
Absolutely. The second half of the century, at least, has been extremely concerned with nuclear technology in general.
I was going to say Gattaca comes immediately to mind, the film, which is about basically genetic engineering to the highest possible degree.
Yeah.
They make perfect people.
Absolutely. Okay, let me add some to those. I think those are all correct. If you look a little earlier in the 20th century, I think you also see things like, as I said, state-sponsored violence and totalitarianism on both the right and the left. Certainly a growing awareness of environmental damage, which has been mostly in the past few decades other than fringe progressive groups, but now is pretty much in the mainstream. Rapid advances in technology in general, including the impact of the Industrial Revolution, which for everyone who saw Blade Runner last night, that first shot I'm going to show you in a minute of the flaming smoke of axe, I think is a perfect little image for the Industrial Revolution right there. Television, computer, information technology, and particularly the way that technology can be used to enhance state control and surveillance. And certainly, as was said, with nuclear power, also the capability of nuclear weapons since the 40s. To provide the utter annihilation of humans and human culture. Again, as I said before, it's important to remember that dystopian fictions, they really reflect the fears and anxieties of the cultural context from which they emerge. That these are not coming out of a vacuum. There's almost always a reason why somebody imagines a future that isn't particularly rosy. Examples of the genre. Anybody want to give me any that we've read or seen in here?
Uh,
don't think we've seen a lot, but there's been a few.
Yeah. They saw it, they had Hal kind of flipping out, and I was like, maybe fear of the artificial intelligence that was kind of really coming
along. Mm-hmm. No, that's a good one. I go back and forth on that. I think there's a dystopian element in 2001. Some of it's kind of rosy, some of it's, you know, this beautiful, sweet technology, you know, everybody seems to be living pretty well, at least one we see.
Seems like the other aspect of that is how sterile they're, even though it's really nice, it's, even like their conversation seems so sterile, it's very, it's not kind of a boring world.
So it's kind of also how you read it, like what you think, you know, what you think the future should look like, you know, your personal opinion. But I think you're right, you know, a lot of people wouldn't make that claim against it, that it's just cold, you know. Yeah.
Time changes because we get there, and the people, because of the clock that has turned into cannibals and non-thinking.
Absolutely. And Wells was actually one of the early progenitors of dystopian fiction. He was well known at the time for that. And I think The Time Machine is certainly his most famous and perhaps his most effective in doing that. I mean, that is a truly horrific culture where you have class warfare played out to the point where the workers are eating the elite. maybe they got their due, but still. Anything else?
Metropolis.
Absolutely. That's good. That may be the first really widely seen dystopian film, certainly. I'm thinking of one more. Anybody else got a few more on?
I think you could argue that War of the Worlds, humans being replaced by another species to be able to set me
aside. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think that's where it becomes blurry, though. I wonder myself when I think about dystopia, how much of it has to do with what we do to ourselves. Threats from the external are certainly valid, and it is a dystopian picture you get of what could happen to the world. But it's not something we do. Although, metaphorically, it could be. There's also all those connections to colonialism, imperialism, et cetera. Yeah, that's why. Yeah, I think that's another one. It's interesting because that one, I think, like a lot of dystopian texts and like some of the ones we've seen in here, you know, you got to play with whether it's even science fiction. It moves, it's such a cultural piece. Not all dystopian fiction has to be science fiction, but I think that definitely has something.
The Final
Story
and iRobot.
Really?
Yeah, where computers
like control everything. Do you think, are you reading that as dystopian? Really? Because I don't get the sense that necessarily the sensibility of the novel itself is there. It seems kind of rosy, like this is a good thing, you know, like these master computers are able to see these problems, resolve them without hurting anybody. I mean, implicit to it is a complete loss of ultimate control, so depends how you read that. That's a good question. I thought about a lot about iRobot. I'm not sure about that one myself. Because Asimov, he really endorses and fetishizes technology so much that it's hard to see how much we're reading that from our perspective after all these decades of dystopian thinking. You know, we're much more steeped in it now than I suspect. Certainly people in 50s. But that's a good call. Well, yeah, that's pretty much what I got. I think Metropolis is the most outrightly straight up, you know, dystopian vision of the future. Well, separate wise, they all work. It's, as I said, it's really one of those places where the line becomes blurred between what's sci-fi and what's not, even whether it's dystopian or not. You know, a lot of it is open to interpretation. Other ones I might throw out along those lines are Brave New World, certainly the Huxley, which was brought up before, written in 1932, you know, in a moment of severe economic depression, and a time when, particularly in the United States, you know, we had our only government that even verged on socialism, and those ideas got out to England where Huxley is, and I could see him thinking, you know, what's the downside of this? You know, how this works. That's a guess. I actually don't know what he was referring to, but I think that maybe Roosevelt had something to do with it. There's something in 1984, as I said before, A Clockwork Orange, as we get more into the modern era. You know, this picture of immoral youth gangs completely numb to violence, you know, roaming the streets of London. I think that's really reflective of particularly the post-war moment in England, the idea that they were once an empire and were no longer, and to a lot of English citizens, England didn't feel like a particularly nice place to live anymore either. It was a very hostile sense in the 60s. The Handmaid's Tale. Anybody read The Handmaid's Tale? Or that one in the film? That one, I think, is a classic dystopian fiction. You know, an extreme patriarchy, extreme religious extremism. environmental damage run amok, where most women are infertile, and those that aren't are enslaved to make babies. A few more, Planet of the Apes. Certainly. Logan's Run, anybody's ever seen that? The Road Warrior movies. The Terminator films, at least in terms of their vision of a potential future of nuclear holocaust. And The Matrix movies. Anyway, that's sort of just a brief little run through the history and some of the sources of dystopian fiction. But now it starts to like thinking about Blade Runner. Blade Runner is I think Lily heralded an era. We were talking in my sections today about whether, you know, how it applies to the stuff we've done already, and I see a little breaking point in the late 70s, early 80s in sci-fi between just the tenor, the tone of what was being addressed. That there was no longer this optimistic view of space exploration and of, you know, meeting sort of the Star Trek view, you know, meeting aliens who we can get along with and share a culture with and all of that. I think it was a much darker view, and that a lot of that, as I'll get into, was related to in general. But let me give you a little background first on this film. It was released in 1982 and was not initially a commercial success. It since, however, has become one of the most influential science fiction films, arguably of all time, particularly in terms, I think, of its vision of a dystopian urban environment, of the, as you can see up there, not very different future. This is not something that's jumping 2 centuries ahead or dealing with a time machine, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. This is something that we're supposed to be able to recognize ourselves in. It's based upon a Philip K. Dick novel entitled Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? But the film is quite different from the original novel, and I'm actually not going to deal with the novel here for that reason, I think. Dick's concerns are a little different than what's going on in the Ripley's Doctor. Originally, the film was considered too dark, too confusing, too ambiguous for mainstream audiences by the studio, particularly in the ending. So at the last minute, a voiceover narration where Harrison Ford describes what's going on in his head, describes parts of the story that aren't necessarily clear, was added on, as well as a happy ending. Have you seen the original version of Blade Runner? If you've seen the director's cut, then you probably can know what I'm talking about. The ending of it is really kind of funny after the whole atmosphere of this film, when suddenly they're in this rural land, you know, driving off to live out, you know, whatever years Rachel has left together and all be well. I actually read something today that legend has it, and it's a pretty reputable source actually, that all those outtakes, or all the imagery of the natural landscape they end up settling in were outtakes from Kubrick's The Shining, from the opening sequences. So, until they were just for the last minute, you know, gotta turn something on. So, Ridley Scott actually got the chance. It was one of his original cuts that was shown at a film festival in 1990, and people just loved it. And so he decided that this is my chance. I'm gonna, you know, release a new version of it. And it's been very popular. It came out in 1991, and it's really actually kind of hard to find the original cut of Blade Runner. I didn't see it in looking around the last week. Ridley Scott himself has been quoted as saying the director's cut is a compromise, actually. It is really his original cut. He couldn't, a lot of that film had been destroyed, and he couldn't access it anymore. But that his original was even darker. That it was even more ambiguous, left more up in the air, which is interesting to think about, because I think the director's cut goes pretty far. Certainly, though, I think, personally, one of the best parts of the director's cut is the lack of the narration. I don't have a problem, generally, with narration in film. A lot of people do. A lot of people go by the tenet that film should show and not tell, that, you know, narrative can be done using the things that are arguably unique to film. But I kind of like it. It reminds me of older types of filmmaking, older types of storytelling that sort of referenced in that way. But the one thing that I noticed in watching it in the director's cut is that without that narration, there's a lot else that comes through. Not only do you focus on the visuals more because you're not listening, you're not to the processing story as it goes along, but there's all this ambient noise that comes out. So, you know, the sounds of the city, things being said, advertising, you know, just sort of bubbling up out of stores and out of radios and all over the place, which you don't really get when you're paying attention to the voiceover. And a lot of that has to do, I think, with the dystopian vision of the film that is thus accentuated by not having that voiceover. But the most often cited dystopian aspects of Blade Runner really involve the straight-up depiction of Los Angeles and of an urban environment in general in 2019. So what I want to do is I want to take a look at a couple clips from the film, and I'd like you guys to pay attention to them. Some of them are quite short. And look for things you would categorize as dystopian that would feed that kind of reading for itself. power of belching flames out of them. Anything else? Any characters? Yeah.
It was more like Earth West. It's all like, not like nature, you know. It's kind of, when we go on vacation and stuff, we're all like, beautiful places and
absolutely, good point. I mean, there's nothing organic as far as the eye can see. In fact, you can't even see the ground. It's just the skyline as far as you know, the frame that we go out of. Absolutely. I thought it was interesting. I'm not really sure what to make of this, but considering that the, you know, the police fly, so this technology is there, the only traffic you see is a police car. There's nothing else going on above it. It's just stagnant at that moment. Yeah?
I was
going to
say that the triangular lights right there and the flaming smokestacks are kind of Metropolis.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And that's the Tyrell Corporation building, if I'm correct.
Yeah,
absolutely. Which is sort of the symbol of corporate power in the film.
A new life awaits you in the off-world colony. The chance to begin again in a golden land of opportunity and adventure.
Different hectic death scene. What do you think? What do you see there? What are the people like in this place? Yeah. Really? Too confusing? Too chaotic? Oh, no one noticed it. Oh, I see. Yeah, good point. Yeah, absolutely. It's like there's sort of an implicit assumption this is a very dangerous place and that kind of thing is going to go on. Yeah, I think you're right. I don't know about you guys, but I've been in certain urban environments where people don't make eye contact at all, or everybody does feel like they're kind of shuffling along, but you'd think when they're getting shoved, when they're getting knocked over, that, yeah, there would be some interaction going on. There really isn't. Anything else?
It's visually dense, and it's also, there's so much stimulation coming from everywhere at all points that you're just trying to follow at least one thing,
mm-hmm.
but there's so many things going on that you can't, and it's chaotic.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just a mixture of all of this
yeah.
stuff. You know, you've got Hare Krishna that's come by. I thought I saw an Orthodox rabbi walk by in the back. It was kind of hard to tell, though. Absolutely. Yeah, it's very dark reading right there. But the dystopia here. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, what I was telling you was about how when they're speaking to each other, the foreign language that they're speaking is a combination of both Spanish and, I think, Japanese also.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally a fusion. And that in its way is kind of dystopian, too. It's the same with the religions. Everything is combined into one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no individuality, and culture has just become this ugly mishmash.
Mm-hmm.
Of.
Did everybody hear that about the language? About the mixture of Japanese and Spanish? You know, if Ridley Scott... did he and his writers sort of come up with that so that they would...
Yeah, I can't remember how they came up with that. I just remember reading that and going, oh, that's cool,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I've studied the movie before.
And your comment's really interesting also because it you know, we have this notion generally that the melting pot is good, that we want diversity, we want everything mixed together, and yet it's a startling image when you see that, when you see that, you know, there are no borders anymore at all, that it's all sort of blending.
Yeah, and it kind of takes away the uniqueness and
yeah.
marginalizes the value.
Yeah,
very
yeah, well said, absolutely. I think that's all right on. I think that scene especially hits on something that is one of the most fundamentally innovative things about the look of this film, and that is those multicultural streets. Dominated by that East Asian imagery, but not just East Asian. I mean, I've heard some Arabic music going on in there. I see all kinds of references to all kinds of cultures just all mixed together. But you do get a sense, I think, that this is not a place where there are a lot of really affluent or rich people running around. This seems like a sense of the underclass, which is, I think, emphasized by the setting itself, by this oppressive, dark, sort of subterranean feel to it. One of the things that made me think about is in the 50s, after World War II, there was this phenomenon that was called back then white flight, which was basically the movement of the affluent white middle class from urban cities to the suburbs. And maybe that's one way we can look at off-world, you know, that's the suburbs. You know, if you can afford it, if you can get away, that's what we do. At one point in the film, J.F. Sebastian, the guy who makes replicants, is asked why he didn't go to the off-world. It seemed like he pretty much couldn't afford it, and that he also seems to have some affinity for this environment. Another thing I think we've seen in all this is a sense of architectural chaos and disorder. This is not an L.A. that is the result of careful planning. It's all been in the San Fernando Valley. Wide streets, all in grids, you know, it's all nice and planned out, it's all set up, you know, be very rational for you to find your way around there. This is not that. There's a mixture of time periods, of international influences. It seems more an irrational city than a rationally planned one. Streets are labyrinth and claustrophobic, as I said. I presume, at least this is an assumption, you don't really get much from the film to go on, but that those of the upper classes who are still living in Los Angeles in 2019 here are living like Tyrell, are living in the upper reaches of skyscrapers, you know, far from that sort of subterranean world going on down there. I came across a reference to the design technique they were using here. They called it, the designers of the film, or the look of the film, called it retrofitting, sort of the way you retrofit hold up to an earthquake, but in the sense that they imagined a city that was based on old buildings that hadn't been cleared away and a new city built there and planned, but that had just been built on top of, randomly had things stuck onto them, which is really a city that's evolved. It's not a city that stems from any particular vision, but one that just comes out of happenstance, out of the random element as years go by. The other thing that I think a few people pointed to that's really right on about it is advertising. Constant backdrop. All through the film, there's just advertising sticking its face in everywhere. The building size billboards, the advertising blimps. The first time I saw the film, I kept thinking of Times Square or some of the pictures. I've never been to Tokyo, but some of those pictures of downtown Tokyo where everything is neon, everything is sort of flashing at you. Pollution, as was noted already. Environmental damage. It's dark. It's raining. It's, you know, you can't tell day or night. You can't tell whether the weather is good or bad. I grew up in L.A. and it never looked like that, even on some of its worst days. The lack of anything organic. was that no trees in sight, whether from the air or on the ground. All the animals all through this film are replicants. There's references to how the real animals are too expensive, which makes you think they're either very rare or not around at all anymore, including the owl, for instance, makes an appearance, Harold's owl, and Dora, the stripper who's running like they're her snake. And one sense, and I think this was hit upon right at the beginning, there's a couple people who said that, you know, what's up with this guy running around with a gun through a crowd and no one's saying anything or, you know, knocking people over. There's no real sign of any government or any authority going on here. It seems a particularly lawless place. Anarchic, there's no real rule of law. And that seems very different from a lot of the other dystopian visions of this oppressive totalitarianism, of Big Brother controlling everything, of that, you know, you have no freedom, but you're safe, ostensibly. So I think there's some real context. You know, as I said before, dystopia really rises out of a very specific context. And I think if you look at the 80s in particular, you can really see where a lot of this is coming from. At least that's my reading of it. First of all, in the early 80s, throughout the 80s, there was a real sense in a lot of mainstream American thinking of a fear of the growing economic power of Japan and Asia, the countries they call the Asian tigers, who have developed so much faster economically than a lot of the rest of the world. There's widely a coverage all through the 80s of Japanese people coming and buying landmark real estate in New York, in these buildings that have been owned by the rich families, the Rockefellers, for years and years, and then now we're being sold to foreign businessmen. One thing to think about, and I'll touch on this a little later also, is that this is not something you see very often. More of the Japanese economy went into recession, I think, 12 or 13 years ago now, and this really defining sense of threat just kind of faded and disappeared. Part of it is coincided with American and European prosperity throughout the night. I think there's also anxiety going on here over globalization and immigration. Globalization in the 80s was not the topic it is now, but it certainly was already. Most people who thought hard about economics and politics could see that it was getting to be a much smaller world very quickly, and that wasn't necessarily going to work out well for everyone. But here I think that maybe they're playing upon fears of foreign threats to some perceived American way of life, you know, a notion that there is a mainstream American culture and that it is threatened, that it can disappear. Once again, I think there's a lot of irony going on in that when you see how culture's actually played out. So I think, you know, quite the opposite. American cultural imperialism is generally criticized in a lot of places of the world because we export so much of our culture, you know, not necessarily with any nefarious design, but just as part of our capitalism. Certainly there were a lot of fears, as there are still, of social disorder, that central government would somehow become impotent in exerting control. The L.A. riots, I think, people still look to as a moment when there was a true anarchic feeling for us today. As I said before, the emerging environmental consciousness in the late 70s and through the 1980s really started to hit the mainstream, really came out of the sort of progressive fringe. And finally, and this one I think it was really prescient, is the emergence over the last few decades of the notion of the megacity, cities that really don't have borders, that are just urban brawl going on until it just sort of peters out. I mean, some theorists think that that's eventually what the whole East Coast is going to be like. If you ever drive up and down, like from Pennsylvania to New Jersey to New York, you really don't ever see any great strip malls and all of that. But I mean, I think when they talk about the megacity, they're talking about places like L.A. or Rio de Janeiro, huge cities that just, you know, used to have these really well-defined borders, but now just stretch. One thing I think we got to think about, though, and you brought up, I think, this point quite early on when I was first talking, is that dystopian fiction like Blade Runner, this view of it as dystopian, is not something everyone's going to agree with. I think a lot of people would look at this, I look at this sometimes, and I see this environment and think it's kind of exciting, it's kind of glamorous, it seems like there's possibility there. It seems like particularly seedy sort of market or club district. So I think one thing we need to keep in mind is that dystopia is really in the eyes of the beholder. There is no single vision of dystopia. It's something that is defined not only by specific places and times and context, but also by specific social groups, where it's rising. So whose dystopia is the best? To me, it seems like it reflects the anxieties of really an affluent, suburban, white middle class. This view of a city environment, which, you know, has been around for a long time, I mean, since the 19th century, certainly in America, our cities got to the point where, you know, the European cities were at, became these dominant urban centers. But this view that they're dangerous, they're chaotic, they're unstable, they're lawless, they're dominated by the other, whatever the other may be, for whatever particular social group you're in. And considering the massive movement in the suburbs that we've seen, not just in the white flight of the city, but in the flight of pretty much everybody who can afford it since then, I think that really has played out. But as I said, not everybody would necessarily agree with that. I think this setting, you know, positive ways to look at it, it offers an awful lot of personal freedom. You can carry your gun around, you can run around, you know, knocking people over. Generally kind of exciting, sort of continual nightlife going on, seemingly, especially if you can't really tell when it's daytime. And particularly relevant to the plot of this film, it seems to allow a certain amount of individual anonymity. You can lose yourself in the city. And that's exactly what the replicants try to do. You know, they leave the outworld to come here and not only try to extend their lives, but remain. And it's ultimately unsuccessful. But you get the sense that if, you know, they didn't have somebody like Decker, who's supposed to be the ultimate Blade Runner, who's the best at his job, chasing them, that they might have been successful. One thing I think, the last thing I would like to say about this film in particular, before I move on, is that this notion of dystopia reflecting the fears not only of a particular time and place, but of a social group, goes along with a lot of the other concerns of the film as well, which Jennifer will get into and we'll be getting into in a section, particularly the notion of enforced slavery for a marginalized second side. They have a very sophisticated cyborgs, but a lot of film plays with that. What does it take to be considered human? Okay, so now I'd like to look at another film that came out around the same time, and I'll look at that pretty quickly, but that I think has similar dystopian themes going on in it, but offers a different picture, responding to some different cultural features of the early and mid-80s, especially. And I kind of like to do a little sort of unscientific survey just to see who's seen this film, actually. It's Brazil by Terry Gilliam. One of the reasons I wanted to actually include this in my lecture today is I felt that I was talking to people these days and no one was watching the film anymore. And it's one of my favorites, has been for a long time, and was really, I think, quite the cultural touchstone for quite a few years. And I'm not really sure why it's fading from prominence as much. Part of it is that the DVD version of it is pretty terrible, I think, and they need to come out with, you know, a better package and sort of promote it. But I think it really both belongs in any discussion of dystopian fiction at this point in time over the last couple decades. So let me give you just a little background on it, and then I want to show one kind of lengthy clip and talk about it really briefly. Brazil and Blade Runner released within 3 years of each other. Brazil came out in 1985. Terry Gilliam directed it. If you're unfamiliar with him, he was in Monty Python. He did the animation for them. It was really distinctive. And he also directed 12 Monkeys and Time Bandits and The Fisher King. And I guess he did the Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I came out of the I didn't see it, but pretty interesting choice. He recently was trying to direct a version of Don Quixote that fell apart completely, to the point that somebody made a documentary about how badly it fell apart. Gilliam claims he got the idea for this film after reading about a practice in the Middle Ages of charging prisoners for the cost of their own torture and imprisonment, which actually happened. And that shows up directly in Brazil. You know, the state decides it's going to recoup its losses. The money it spends to come get you and brainwash you, you know, they shouldn't have to pay for that. So they're going to come get it from you. Like Ridley Scott, Gilliam also had trouble releasing the versions he wanted to release. The studio also considered it too dark, depressing, and uncommercial. And he had actually some very public battles with Universal, with the studio, about getting it released. He took out an ad in Variety magazine that just said, "Dear Universal, when are you going to release my film?" Signed Terry Gilliam, big full-page ad. Supposedly Robert De Niro, who's in the movie, like, sent him a letter in character. He plays this kind of swashbuckling rebel terrorist guy, saying, "We're all in it together," you know, which is a touchstone or a phrase from the film. The film, however, once it did get released, it did. Eventually, Gilliam basically won out and released pretty much the film he wanted to. It was a huge critical success. It was beloved by critics and actually did pretty well commercially. And I think you'll see, if you've seen it, or hopefully from the clips I'm going to show you, that it's a little more like the dystopian fictions of the early and mid-19th century, in the sense that it's really more concerned with totalitarian government. It's not the sort of anarchic, you know, formless, out-of-control kind of scenario, but too much control. Faceless bureaucracy, surveillance. A lot of issues that Blade Runner, you know, has elements of, but doesn't really go the same way. So let me just set this up really fast, because the clips I'm going to show you, especially the first one, it's very dense. I listened really carefully. I had to watch it a few times to get everything from it. A lot is just going on in each frame. But basically, the film is set somewhere in the 20th century, as it says, in an unspecified time and place, that has very futuristic overtones, but doesn't seem to necessarily be the future. It's got some very retro technology. There's no digital technology. Everything is clunky and analog. You know, they use vacuum tubes to get messages between people and corporations. There's heating ducts everywhere. The nation that is being portrayed, who we never find out who it is ruled by a seemingly all-powerful bureaucratic central government and is besieged by a campaign of terrorist bombings that is now reportedly in 13 years. Makes us think about the current world we're living in a little bit. Corporate entities in this film are also extremely powerful and sometimes distinctly indistinguishable from the government. Hard to see where the boundaries can be drawn between them. And the story itself is about a low-level bureaucratic employee that works for the government named Sam Lowry, who escapes from this grim reality he lives in every day through these really intense, really visual dreams, all of which are in the film, and just provide these moments where suddenly you break out of this stress environment. Completely different thing. And in this dream life, he's a noble hero, and he's fighting evil to save this beautiful mystery woman, who later he meets up with, turns out to be one of them. Eventually, he becomes involved with these terrorists, who turn out to be an underground group fighting the government, led sort of in a certain way by the Robert De Niro character, fighting for the rights of the individual, for individual autonomy. So as I said, these clips are a little chaotic, bear with me and with it, and see what you can find them. I think especially the first one is pretty fascinating.
Mother would be appalled at your lack of promotion.
Mother, I just wish you would stop interfering. I don't want promotion. I'm happy where I am.
No, you're not. Jack Lynch is a lesson to you. He doesn't have your brains, but he's got the ambition. You haven't got the ambition. Luckily, you've got me and the Deputy Minister. Mr. Helfman was very close
and
to your...
Please, Mrs. Lowry, don't get upset.
You are a genius. Would you like to be Surgeon General? I know simply everybody.
Well, they won't know you when I've finished with you. First, we remove the excess derma. Tissues under the eyes, forehead.
I'm
missed you.
I don't have much time, but let me just go through really quick a couple of things you're talking about. The food, you know, artisans everywhere. You get little pictures of the food that you should be tasting, and little lumps of amorphous jelly sitting there. Advertising, again, has a continual backdrop. In fact, all through the film, there's advertising everywhere. Some of it's quite bizarre and twisted. At one point, there's an advertisement for a vacation resort. The Mellow Fields Top Security Holiday Camp, featuring luxury without fear, fun without suspicion, and an invitation to relax in a panic-free atmosphere. These security concerns, terrorism, you know, everywhere, except there's a feeling that they've learned to live with it. You know, he puts the screen behind them, so they continue having lunch. You know, the conversation barely breaks. Meanwhile, there's this horrific scene going on in the back with the ambulances and just mess. So I guess I'd just like to close by saying, by referencing Ursula Le Guin one more time, as we have many times. She says in the introduction to the sci-fi anthology we have that the role of science fiction isn't to predict the future. But I think it's interesting to look at exactly how prescient these films are. And also look at the elements that haven't really played out as predicted. I mean, in terms of what they have predicted, well, I think terrorism is becoming a widespread means of warfare. And as a result, security measures enacted that we might not have been able to imagine before, and people getting used to its presence in our culture. Multinational corporations becoming as powerful as nation states, and the line between them being blurred, you know, where you don't know what is a corporate entity and where your government begins. Increase in this omnipresent advertising culture, especially in Blade Runner. You look at things like corporate endorsement, the, you know, official Frito-Lay Super Bowl coin toss, you know, Staples Center in L.A. I mean, I grew up there, and I remember the good old Fabulous Forum, you know, and it was the Great Western Forum, of course. Now there's the Staples Center. And globalization, economic and cultural. The world has gotten a lot smaller, and there is more mixing of diverse cultural influences, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's sort of based on any kind of egalitarian sensibility, as we can see in our more rosier pictures of what globalization could be about. On the other hand, as I've said, global influences haven't really come, you know, they haven't had the influence here that seemed to be a fear underlying what was going on in Blade Runner there. You don't see Japanese culture everywhere. You see a mix, maybe more than we did in the 60s, certainly more than in the 30s, but it's certainly nothing compared to the anxiety that is being portrayed there. And I think that leads me to really what I'm most interested in and what I want to leave you guys with, which is that the most valuable thing that we can get from dystopian fiction isn't really a view of what's going to happen, but of what we fear will happen, of what's going on, you know, with our own anxiety. Fears we don't necessarily express clearly or examine as much as we should. And these stories, they can really make you think about why we fear certain things in our own culture and in other cultures, and whether those fears are valid or in themselves can be destructive or dangerous.